Welcome to Plastics Unwrapped, a series supported by Dow, the materials science company. I'm your host, Maitri Sitharaman. In this podcast, we're on the hunt for solutions to some of the toughest challenges facing the plastics industry. We're going to try and have some seriously honest conversations with guests from across sectors and from across the world. So let's together figure out what it'll really take to save the future of our planet. In this episode and the next, we're shifting gears, literally, into the world of luxury cars. Think my favorite, Ferrari 308 GTB, or the BMW M1, or the Corvette. What do they all have in common? Well, it's plastic. Because before it got a bad rap, plastic really helped shape some of the most iconic cars ever built. Even now, about 50% of a car's volume is plastic, but here's the kicker, barely 19% gets recycled. What happens to all that plastic when the car's time on this planet is up? Here's the thing. Luxury tends to lead the way when it comes to cutting-edge innovation, where they can afford to be futuristic, before it all trickles down to the cars we all drive. So what's being tested in high-end garages today could be rolling into mass-market driveways of tomorrow. In this episode, we'll look under the hood to see what's in the way, recycling challenges, new regulations, and what's driving change. But more importantly, who needs to be in the driver's seat? How do we close the loop? Can luxury actually go fully circular? Let's find out. To break it all down, we've got two experts at the forefront of this transformation. Alison Nuttall, she's the Head of Sustainability Global Affairs at JLR, and Shalise Lee, Global Automotive Plastics Circularity Team Leader at Dow. Ladies, can we actually make luxury cars fully circular? Are we chasing this impossible dream? Because Alison, JLR announced its reimagined strategy a few years ago, bold net zero targets across supply chain, production, operations, and, you know, gosh, by 2039. Your CEO has said you've achieved some key milestones this year. What does reimagine really mean for you guys in the context of plastic circularity?
Yeah, so our reimagined strategy means exactly that, to reimagine everything that we're doing, the way that we're designing, engineering, the way that we work with our partners, our supply chains, and for our customers. Climate change is the defining issue of our time, and we know that road transport plays a huge part in that. It's responsible for around 12% of global greenhouse gas emissions, and that's its use phase alone. So those embodied emissions associated with the materials that we use are really, really critical for us to address. There cannot be a net zero without a circular economy. Decarbonisation is not enough. So how we are addressing our materials and our plastics in particular becomes really, really important.
Liz, how does Dow's work and the innovation that you're doing within the mobility space with plastics really help, you know, folks at JLR and some of the other OEMs that you're working with?
First, let's talk about plastics in cars, because they're everywhere, playing a much bigger role than you might think. You see them in the obvious places like sturdy bumpers in the exterior, the sleek dashboards and stylish trims and interiors, but they're also working behind the scenes, tucked into seat foams, acoustics, and even hoses under the hood. And here's the thing. Every single one of these components has to meet incredibly high standards. It's about creating a great driving experience, making sure materials have a great look and feel and even smell. But it's also about performance. Automotive plastics need to be lightweight, durable, and most importantly, safe. Now, add sustainability into the mix, say, incorporating recycled content, and things can get even more complex. This is where deep expertise in both material science and in automotive performance comes in. And that's exactly what we do, developing innovative technologies that help automotive players achieve sustainability targets while ensuring that plastics continue to deliver what they're meant to: lightweighting, efficiency, standout design, a great driver experience overall, and of course, uncompromising safety.
So how do you close the loop and still stay luxury with that idea in people's heads, Alison, that luxury is meant to be something special, something new, but we're talking about, you know, circularity here?
luxury and sustainability should not be mutually exclusive. You know, these are two things that can and should go hand in hand. Many of the traditional values of luxury, quality, longevity, exclusivity, they're also values of sustainability. And what we have here is a real opportunity to really make it real that we can do through materials, through this innovation that Liz has talked about. We can turn these into tangible examples to show the customers through the product how this loop can be closed and how we can be protecting the resource use through luxury.
This also allows you the bandwidth to lead the way, right? Because if you look at fashion, luxury tends to lead the way for many of the trends in sustainability. So in cars, it's great to see that that's happening as well. And when it comes to regulatory push, you guys have the bandwidth then to actually make changes and show some of the other mass market brands it's doable and make it cheaper, because it's expensive to put new models out onto the road. The EU's new regulations that are kicking in at the end of the year, the end of life vehicle directive, which is going to become regulation, some of the targets that they're setting are pretty phenomenal. 25% plastic in new vehicles, must be recycled content, stricter reusability, recyclability, recoverability rates, a vehicle circularity passport's been talked about. I mean, how are you preparing for these regulations? How much of that trickle down will happen to the more mass market brands?
We've been working very closely with policymakers, with industry organizations to really understand the detail behind that. Because what's clear is that how we collaborate across the supply chain is going to be absolutely fundamental to ensuring that we can meet these regulations and deliver luxury for the customer. It provides a real opportunity to get into some really exciting industry-first solutions that will mean that not only are we meeting that legislation, but that, of course, we're also able to make some breakthroughs to meet our net zero ambitions. We know that decarbonisation is not enough. Circular economy has to be a big part of that. And this means investigating new ways of working with the supply chain. So looking to established closed loop supply chains, looking at where feedstock is coming from, and really fundamentally rethinking the way that we operate with suppliers and with partners to ensure that we're able to get access to recycled material and that we're able to get that come back through our supply chain, go through the testing and ensure that it can be made into the high value quality product that the customer expects and really retain the value of that material. That's the key thing here, is that we don't allow that material to degrade, but we're able through those supply chain collaborations to maintain its value.
Liz, that brings up a question of the industry-wide impact. I mean, not everybody has the bandwidth of the luxury guys, right? What are they telling you in terms of the kind of mandates that have been set and the availability of folks to do the recycling that, you know, European regulators want them to do?
We have to address these pressing concerns. I mean, for me personally, the climate crisis is of prime importance. It is as well true for Dow. That's why we've had to commit as well. By 2030, we'll have 3 million metric tons of circular renewable solutions annually. By 2050, we intend to be carbon neutral for not just scope 1 and 2, our shop, but also scope 3 and how we offer the benefits back to the industry, because we do want to address the climate crisis and this waste problem, especially with the mandate from the regulators. This actually syncs with what we see as well as a true need. Only 19% of car plastics are recycled today in Europe. The rest are incinerated and landfilled. This is something that needs our attention. And so how has the industry responded, the materials industry, so meaning my peers and the supply chain that Allison just described? Yes, let's do this. Let's do this together. We have technologies to bring that will enable circularity. We just need to accelerate them. We're ready.
And what about the OEMs that you're working with? Because JLR is one company, but you guys are working across the OEM space. What are they telling you?
There will be a diversity of points of view. And I think there will always be somebody like JLR who sees the climate crisis and the need to work on it yesterday, who will be in the forefront of driving the rest of the supply chain to address the needs for circular economy. It is a challenge, right? It is not an easy task, meaning we do need to rethink of how, or reimagine, I would say, how we do things. Not just as individual companies, but even how to set up the ecosystem right from the very beginning. And that means having open conversations and collaborations, even with our non-so-usual players at hand. And that means looking at all technologies at play. We should use and leverage everything in our toolbox, from design, thinking from the very beginning already at the end of life of the vehicle, where would it go, to mechanical recycling, meaning incorporating recycled content today with mechanical recycling methods, but also chemical recycling, because there are diverse waste streams that is more complex. And therefore, we need to think of like ways to intermediates or ways to feedstocks type of technology, so we can enable circularity of these materials in diverse ways.
You bring up a really interesting point, Liz, because I want to then ask a question probably as a consumer, because I am neither an auto expert or a material sciences expert, but I do love my cars. Who pays for this? Like, do I as a customer end up with the price tag attached to all of the green that we've seen? Should automakers bear the cost of plastic recovery? Should plastic manufacturers like you at Dow pick it up? I mean, should this be an extended producer responsibility kind of situation? Or do we need to give consumers like me an incentive, right? Give back your car to the automakers. Give me some kind of benefit to giving you the car instead of making, 3.5 million cars on the roads of Europe disappear magically. What is a good solution to actually start collecting the plastic? But I want to understand, who pays for this?
Clearly, at the start of something like a transition to a circular economy, there are going to be huge costs that are involved in industrializing and in scaling up. And there needs to be incentivization in that space to ensure that the circular economy can kick off. I think it's already been shown and been proven that in the long term, there are returns, financial returns. It makes sense for the business case when it comes to circular economy. But with anything, there is that industrialization cost at the start. So I think there needs to be a range of ways in which that is addressed and dealt with. And of course, the policy, some of the policy instruments coming out of different countries is one of the ways to do that. I think that collaboration with end of life, with customers as well, is a really, really good point to raise, and absolutely one that we should be looking into. But whilst also not forgetting that we want our vehicles to remain on the road for as long as possible, which from a JLR point of view actually can be up to 20 years and might be through a number of customers. So it brings an additional challenging element. How do we get that longevity and still have access to those materials at the end of the life of the product as well?
Alison, if I can put this to you, inconsistent global regulations make supply chains really complicated, not to say, you know, the geopolitics of it. Will this slow down circularity efforts, or is being based in Europe, in the UK, kind of helping set a tonality? Are you leading there as well? Or is that like going to put you on a back foot with all of these markets you're in?
I think there's two things here to consider. One of them is the that policy and the legislation view of it. But the other one is the standards that we set ourselves. So as a global enterprise, as you say, operating across many markets, actually we have a JLR standard that we stick to, and that applies to all markets regardless of what is the, you know, the specific requirements in those. We will always be going for the best. So if that is the EU, or if it's some of the circular economy work that's going to come out of the UK, JLR will be ensuring that we're building in being able to deliver the best, and not just the bare minimum, but of course that going above and beyond. And that will then apply to all markets. It doesn't make sense, I think, for a circular economy to be driven market by market. I think a full global approach is the way to address this.
Where are you seeing your customers specifically be more interested in this circular model?
We've got some interesting pilots going on at the moment around the sort of the downstream circularity part of things. So when it comes to those ownership models or sort of usership, as it we might be shifting to, I think in such a ever increasing dynamic, fast-paced world that we live in, actually people having access to luxury vehicles when they need them, which might come through a different model other than the traditional ownership, is something that we're seeing certainly in Europe some real interest in. We've got a couple of programs that are running where people can have, you know, access to the luxury vehicle for up to 18 months, much more flexible if they're traveling, and it's an interesting area to keep an eye on.
That's brilliant. Again, Liz, I want to come back to you mentioned Scope 3. Loads of companies get scared when you start talking about Scope 3. And they're worried about, you know, how they're going to keep track of it. How do they get everybody on board? When you look at all the folks you work with, is Scope 3 the terrifying bump in the road where they pause and say, oh, hang on, we've got potential tariffs coming down the road, we've got to, you know, get your cash flow set? Or is Scope 3 on everyone's mind at this point as the hill they must climb?
For the automotive industry, it is in everyone's mind, because not just policy, but Scope 3 carbon emissions also mean tailpipe emissions, meaning during the lifetime of a car. That is why we are working on lightweighting the vehicle, but not just that, also electrifying the fleet, enabling solutions that will enable battery electric vehicles to be on the road, and other new energy vehicle solutions as well. And what also Scope 3 means for a supplier, or, you know, like a plastic supplier like Dow, is like the Scope 1 and 2 of a customer like JLR. That means as well helping think of like their production process. How do we also make lower energy use possible for their production process and their tier one production processes as well? So we need to think all of this throughout the value chain, from not just in our shop, but at the same time delivering all of the properties I just said, like about look and feel and touch and acoustics and odor, and most importantly as well, safety.
So Alison, final question to you then. Scope 3, you've gone and introduced a brand new, almost like an ideology, which is the Jaguar Type 00. But again, that's a fantastic idea that, you know, luxury car makers put out there. You've got a lot of, you know, things going on at JLR to deal with. Scope 3, will that be the hill that you're willing to then die on when all of this is going on?
I think there's a couple of ways that we're addressing our Scope 3, and by far the biggest chunk for us is in those tailpipe emissions. So our strategy to shift to electrification, whether that's through the reimagining of Jaguar as an all-electric brand, or it's the introduction of EV models in all of our other house of brands, that takes care of such a huge part of our Scope 3 emissions, which then allows us to focus on the upstream Scope 3 emissions, which is where these really sort of interesting, innovative ways of dealing with materials comes to play. I think it will be a hill that we will keep climbing. And I think that as we progress on that journey, we will see more people understanding the business case, seeing the economic as well as environmental and social benefits of it, particularly when it comes to that maximizing the value of our resources. I think we will keep driving up it.
So, Alison, final word to you. Are we going to get more exciting, internet-breaking, Jaguar-type 00 actions from you guys and set everybody's tongues on fire, get everyone's mind blown with all of the things you have planned ahead? You don't copy anyone. I remember that line.
Absolutely. Copy of nothing. And the world will see more of that vehicle as it progresses towards its launch. And also coming soon will be the new Range Rover Electric as well. So there will be a lot of exciting things to look out for from JLR, that's for sure.
Oh, London Blue is going to be my pick when I decide which one, if it ever hits the market and I can afford it. London Blue is going to be my car. On that note, Alison, Liz, thank you so, so very much for steering us through the complexities of the plastic circularity within the luxury car space. It's really helped me understand how you're dealing with the issue.
That's a wrap, but don't hit the brakes just yet. We're going to be back with JLR to tackle the technical roadblocks to sustainability. How is a luxury car maker like JLR engineering its way through? Find out in the final episode of this season of Plastics Unwrapped. See you at the finish line.